File 11. So long as there are employers who attack social understanding and have wrong ideas of justice and fair play, it is not only the right, but also the duty of their employees, who after all are an integral part of our people, to protect the general interests against the greed and unreason of the individual. For to safeguard the loyalty and confidence of the people is as much in the interests of the nation as to safeguard public health. Both are seriously menaced by dishonorable employers who are not conscious of their duty as members of the national community. Their personal avidity or irresponsibility sows the seeds of future trouble. To eliminate the causes of such a development is an action that surely deserves well of the country. It must not be answered here that the individual workman is free at any time to escape from the consequences of an injustice which he has actually suffered at the hands of an employer, or which he thinks he has suffered. In other words, he can leave. No, that argument is only a ruse to detract attention from the question at issue. Is it, or is it not, in the interests of the nation to remove the causes of social unrest? If it is, then the fight must be carried on with the only weapons that promise success. But the individual workman is never in a position to stand up against the might of the big employer, for the question here is not one that concerns the triumph of right. If in such a relation right had been recognized as the guiding principle, then the conflict could not have arisen at all. But here it is a question of who is the stronger. If the case were otherwise, the sentiment of justice alone would solve the dispute in an honorable way, or to put the case more correctly, matters would not have come to such a dispute at all. No. If unsocial and dishonorable treatment of men provokes resistance, then the stronger party can impose its decision in the conflict until the constitutional legislative authorities do away with the evil through legislation. Therefore, it is evident that if the individual workman is to have any chance at all of winning through in the struggle, he must be grouped with his fellow workmen and present a united front before the individual employer, who incorporates in his own person the massed strength of the vested interests of the industrial or commercial undertaking which he conducts. Thus, the trade unions can hope to inculcate and strengthen a sense of social responsibility in workaday life and open the road to practical results. In doing this, they tend to remove those causes of friction which are a continual source of discontent and complaint. Blame for the fact that the trade unions do not fulfill this much desired function must be laid at the doors of those who barred the road to legislative social reform, or rendered such a reform ineffective by sabotaging it through their political influence. The political bourgeoisie failed to understand, or rather, they did not wish to understand, the importance of the trade union movement. The Social Democrats accordingly seized the advantage offered them by this mistaken policy and took the labor movement under their exclusive protection without any protest from the other side. In this way, they established for themselves a solid bulwark behind which they could safely retire whenever the struggle assumed a critical aspect. Thus, the genuine purpose of the movement gradually fell into oblivion and was replaced by new objectives. for the Social Democrats never troubled themselves to respect and uphold the original purpose for which the trade union movement was founded. They simply took over the movement, lock, stock and barrel, to serve their own political ends. Within a few decades, the trade union movement was transformed by the expert hand of social democracy from an instrument which had been originally fashioned for the defence of human rights into an instrument for the destruction of the national economic structure. The interests of the working class were not allowed for a moment to cross the path of this purpose, for in politics the application of economic pressure is always possible if the one side be sufficiently unscrupulous and the other sufficiently inert and docile. In this case, both conditions were fulfilled. By the beginning of the present century, the trade unionist movement had already ceased to recognize the purpose for which it had been founded. From year to year, it fell more and more under the political control of the Social Democrats, until it finally came to be used as a battering ram in the class struggle. The plan was to shelter, by means of constantly repeated blows, the economic edifice in the building of which so much time and care had been expended. Once this objective had been reached, the destruction of the state would become a matter of course, because the state would already have been deprived of its economic foundations. Attention to the real interests of the working classes, on the part of the Social Democrats, steadily decreased until the cunning leaders saw that it would be in their immediate political interests if the social and cultural demands of the broad masses remained unheeded. For there was a danger that if these masses once felt content, they could no longer be employed as mere passive material in the political struggle. The gloomy prospect which presented itself to the eyes of the condottieri of the class warfare, if the discontent of the masses were no longer available as a war weapon, created so much anxiety among them that they suppressed and oppressed even the most elementary measures of social reform, and conditions were such that those leaders did not have to trouble about attempting to justify such an illogical policy. As the masses were taught to increase and heighten their demands, the possibility of satisfying them dwindled, and whatever ameliorative measures were taken became less and less significant, so that it was at that time possible to persuade the masses that this ridiculous measure in which the most sacred claims of the working classes were being granted represented a diabolical plan to weaken their fighting power in this easy way, and if possible, to paralyze it. One will not be astonished at the success of these allegations if one remembers what a small measure of thinking power the broad masses possess. In the bourgeois camp, there was high indignation over the bad faith of the Social Democrats' tactics, but nothing was done to draw a practical conclusion and organize a counterattack from the bourgeois side. The fear of the Social Democrats to improve the miserable conditions of the working classes ought to have induced the bourgeois parties to make the most energetic efforts in this direction, and thus snatch from the hands of the class warfare leaders their most important weapon. But nothing of this kind happened. Instead of attacking the position of their adversaries, the bourgeoisie allowed itself to be pressed and harried. Finally, it adopted means that were so tardy and so insignificant that they were ineffective and were repudiated. So the whole situation remained just as it had been before the bourgeois intervention, but the discontent had thereby become more serious. Like a threatening storm, the Free Trades Union hovered above the political horizon and above the life of each individual. It was one of the most frightful instruments of terror that threatened the security and independence of the national economic structure, the foundations of the state, and the liberty of the individual. Above all, it was the Free Trades Union that turned democracy into a ridiculous and scorned phrase, insulted the ideal of liberty, and stigmatized that of fraternity with the slogan, "If you will not become our comrade, we shall crack your skull." It was thus that I then came to know this friend of humanity. During the years that followed, my knowledge of it became wider and deeper, but I have never changed anything in that regard.